The 10th chapter, Ecclesiastes, which you find along with the other wisdom books, Proverbs, and the Song of Songs, after the Psalter. Ecclesiastes chapter 10. As dead flies give perfume a bad smell, so a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. The heart of the wise inclines to the right, but the heart of the fool to the left. Even as he walks along the road, the fool lacks sense and shows everyone how stupid he is. If a ruler's anger rises against you, do not leave your post. Calmness. Somebody else translates it deference. Can lay great errors to rest. There is an evil I have seen under the sun, says the preacher. The sort of error that arises from a ruler. Fools are put in many high positions, while the rich occupy the low ones. I have seen slaves on horseback, while princes go on foot like slaves. Whoever digs a pit may fall into it. Whoever breaks through a wall may be bitten by a snake. Whoever quarries stones may be injured by them. Whoever splits logs may be endangered by them. If the axe is dull and its edge unsharpened, more strength is needed, but skill will bring success. If a snake bites before it is charmed, there is no profit for the charmer. Words from a wise man's mouth are gracious, but a fool is consumed by his own lips. At the beginning, his words are folly. At the end, they are wicked madness, and the fool multiplies words. No one knows what is coming. Who can tell him what will happen after him? A fool's work wearies him. He does not know the way to town. Woe to you, O land, whose king was a servant. A child, it might be, perhaps better a servant, and whose princes feast in the morning. Blessed are you, O land, whose king is of noble birth, and whose princes eat at a proper time, for strength and not for drunkenness. If a man is lazy, the rafters sag. If his hands are idle, the house leaks. A feast is made for laughter, and wine makes life merry. But money, says the preacher, is the answer for everything. You would understand that he's saying this in a particular context. In fact, under the sun, he's describing life all through this book, under the sun, mortal, human, fallen life as it is. It's perhaps one of the most realistic books in the whole Bible. Do not revile the king even in your thoughts, or curse the rich in your bedroom, because a bird of the air may carry your words, and a bird on the wing may report what you say. Amen. May God bless to us his holy word.
Ecclesiastes chapter 10. Now this chapter takes us a little further along the road towards that Christian sanity and reasonableness which views life down here somewhat philosophically, and which suggests in the most unspoken but yet evident way that there is or may be, indeed there is, a wisdom in operation from another realm which may be applied to the quirks and the queernesses of human life down here. It is as if there was in this book of Ecclesiastes a conspiracy of silence that perplexes believing people, as the vanity of earthly life is being fully tabulated, which perplexes us until we have sometimes been almost climbing the wall during these studies with the depressing inevitableness of life under the sun, and yet dare not breathe that there is also a life down here connected with above the sun. It has seemed sometimes almost like a game, as if the book was saying rather self-consciously, now don't mention the obvious to religious people. It's a little like in the philosophy classroom, where the uninitiated has to be told, you don't spoil the philosophic game by introducing God and heaven. Keep up the pretense, as if he weren't there. Because you see, if you bring God in a sense, you dismiss a great deal that is called philosophy. Not all. Then, you see, in these circumstances, when we can own him and recognize him, almost unspoken of in this book, although his name appears a number of times, when we do recognize him and own him and see that he lies behind all the seeming cynicism of the writer, the preacher, he will be all the more precious to us, and we'll be fervently glad, as we have been at the close of the service these Sunday evenings, more and more and more, how glad we are that there's more to life than this book says. And that's why it's written. I wonder if you follow that line of reasoning. It's only one way, of course, of looking at the Ecclesiastes, which is a very studied book, and it's a very studied way of looking at it, almost cynically. But if you understand C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters, you'll be the better able to understand this book. But to the text of it, chapter 10. Folly here is shown up badly as an odious thing in face of wisdom and honor. And we are told that it only takes a little of a bad smell to pollute the air, whereas it takes a lot of perfume to sweeten it. And there's a marvelous lesson on this line, you know. That is the comparative influence of good and evil. A marvelous lesson about this in the little prophecy of Haggai. The prophet is asking in the second chapter, verses 10 to 14, he's asking, will consecrated meat, that is called the sacrifice in the temple, or having been sacrificed in the temple, will consecrated meat touching other meat
even by the fold of the garment in which it is carried. Will such consecrated meat make the other meat holy? The answer is no. All right then. If someone defiled, in Israel's eyes, by touching a dead body, touches one of those things, will he pollute it? And the answer is, oh yes. Evil, alas, is more virulent and prevalent and influential short term than good. Is that not so? What were the last words of Ecclesiastes chapter 9? Wisdom is better than war. Wisdom is better than weapons of war. But one sinner destroys much good. That's it. So much for verse 1 of our chapter. Verse 2. Look at that. The heart of the wise inclines to the right or to the right hand, but the heart of the fool to the left. Now, Derek Kidner, commenting on this, tries to tone down verse 2 by quoting it from the version of the Jerusalem Bible. And this is what it says there. The wise man's heart leads him aright. The fool's heart leads him astray. But then, you see, the right hand and the left have always expressed the good and the bad, as we see from our Lord, Matthew 25 and 33, when he puts the sheep on his right hand and the goats on his left. And the very word sinister is the word for the left hand. But the meaning, of course, is more fully brought out in verse 3. You see that. Even as he walks along the road, the fool lacks sense and shows everyone how stupid he is. Where to be left-handed in this sense, not in the mere physical sense, but to be left-handed in this sense, is to be foolish, ham-fisted, you might say. And to the degree that the foolish person walking along the road proclaims his folly, which others would not see, but for his drawing attention to it, he fails even to be wise enough to hide it. But he simply can't, because that's part of his folly. Now, of course, thinking about hiding things suggests something else. We know that there is a sophistication which labors at great effort and cost to show itself to be other than in fact it is. That is plain hypocrisy. But all we are saying here, or rather the text is saying, is that if the fool weren't so foolish, the world might not know what a fool he is. And he might even, in fact, become less foolish than he was. Perhaps the fool could learn.
Well, we've all seen ourselves as foolish sometimes. Am I alone in that? And perhaps we have learned a little, at least to hide our folly in its most obvious manifestations, and pray to be made more wise. Verse 4. Here's a word at verse 4, another subject, which gives good advice. If a ruler's anger rises against you, do not leave your post. Calmness, or whatever word you put in there, calmness can lay great errors to rest. If for some reason, and it may be completely inadvertent or thoughtless on our part, if for some reason we enrage authority, there is a way to make the best of the situation and not the worst of it, exacerbating it. Keep calm. Don't run around in panic trying to quell authority's anger by feverish efforts. That may only make it worse.
calmness, poise, whatever inferno is going on inside, calmness, poise, quiet assurance can often take command of a situation which has all the elements of a furore, as the Italians say. Now, as I said earlier, Kidner suggests deference here for the word calmness in the New International Version as the meaning of the word. The Authorized Version has yielding pacifies great offenses. Kidner gives as an example of this not going off in a huff and resigning one's post when one has caused the anger of those in authority. And he cites 1 Peter 2 and 18 as an example. Slaves, says Peter, submit yourselves to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and considerate, but also to those who are harsh. But I still think that an attitude of quiet poise is a great help. Compare the opposite, if I may, in the public behavior of politicians these days. Enough said. Verses 5 to 7 tell another story. That of fools in charge of affairs and wise men having to take lowly places and endure the prattling and the ill decisions of nonentities. It may be that you don't care for the contrast between the foolish and the rich here, because it grates in these modern socialistically minded days. But the figure is exceedingly telling nonetheless, as it sees the slave riding high on horseback and the prince walking behind. The nearest to this I ever saw was driving into Jerusalem from the airport, for the first time driving on the right-hand side of the road in a hired Volkswagen, when Tom Swanson and I were stirred to roars of laughter by suddenly coming upon a great hulking man riding on a tiny donkey, his feet almost touching the ground, and a poor Arab woman dutifully walking behind. It was incredible. But you see, the folly of that, doubtless, would not have appealed to the Arab, even if he had seen us laughing. You see the point. The onlooker, we may say, sees a great deal of the game. We need to be discerning observers when we will not only get much wholesome fun out of life, but see how ludicrous we also may appear to others now and then in our stylized antics and in our too sober selfishness. This, of course, has a political slant to it as well, and which some today are trying to balance a bit, since it is true that the workers have really become the bosses in our day. Do you not think so? Surely. Surely. Interestingly enough, one will not find such fulsome arrogance amongst the members of the House of Lords, which seems to be, from what one hears of it, rather modestly run and a much quieter place, certainly, than the House of Commons. You'll not find that kind of arrogance as you do amongst some trade union bosses. The very attitude of some shop stewards is odious to all but their own breed and to the bitterly class conscious. I am sure that genuinely Christian labor people are often quite embarrassed by the odiousness of some of those who represent them. But we might well say, let us have a little more Christian spirit in all the parties. None of them have an excess of that by any means, don't you think? That's something to pray about these days, when there's so much talk. Christians should be praying hard about the quality and the character of the individuals who are voted onto Parliament, rather than labels. That's more important. But take verses 8 to 11 together. 8 to 11. Whoever digs a pit may fall into it. Whoever breaks through a wall may be bitten by a snake. Whoever quarries stones may be injured by them. Whoever splits logs may be endangered by them. If the axe is dull and its edge unsharpened, more strength is needed, but skill will bring success. As if the axe couldn't be sharpened. If a snake bites before it is charmed, there is no profit for the charmer. Now, what are these verses really about? Well, they are about realism. That's what they're about. Realism. Facing the facts of life, of this life, in this fallen world, which is still God's world. We live in a real world, a living world. And everything living has its dangers. It's dangerous to be alive and to breathe, as well as not to, of course. As we learned in chapter 9, verses 5 and 6. The living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no further reward, and even the memory of them is forgotten. Their love, their hate, and their jealousy have long since vanished. Never again will they have a part in anything that happens under the sun. Because the grave is a peaceful place. There are never any disturbances from the inhabitants of cemeteries, although there will be one day. But in a world of dynamics, including dynamical personalities, anything can happen. And it usually does. Is there a touch of the sinful about the digging of the pit here in verse 8? Is that why the digger may himself fall into the pit he has dug? There's an awful lot about that in the Psalter. Let me give you some examples. Psalm 7:15. He who digs a hole and scoops it out falls into the pit he has made. 9:15. The nations have fallen into the pit they have dug. Their feet are caught in the net they have hidden. 35, 7 and 8. Since they hid their net for me without cause, and without cause dug a pit for me, may ruin overtake them by surprise. May the net they hid entangle them. May they fall into the pit, to the ruin. And Psalm 57 and 6. They spread a net for my feet. I was bowed down in distress. They dug a pit in my path. But they have fallen into it themselves. Selah, it says after that. What fun. Psalm 141, we looked at this last night. 141 verses 9 and 10. Keep me from the snares they have laid for me, from the traps set by evildoers. Let the wicked fall into their own net, while I pass by in safety. And that's not all in the scriptures about that. That's the pit then, and the digger of the pit. Something odious suggested there. And the serpent, what about the serpent? Is there a sinister suggestion here with regard to the serpent? Look at the prophecy of Amos. Amos 5 and 18. Amos 5 and 18. Woe to you who long for the day of the Lord. Why do you long for the day of the Lord? That day will be darkness. For the wicked, that is, not light. It will be as though a man fled from a lion only to meet a bear, as though he entered his house and rested his hand on the wall only to have a snake bite him. Will not the day of the Lord be darkness, not light, pitch darkness, without a ray of brightness? And again in Amos 9 and 3 says, as do the wicked, though they hide themselves on the top of Carmel, there I will hunt them down and seize them, though they hide from me at the bottom of the sea. There I will command, fearful thing for the Lord to say concerning those of Israel, there I will command the serpent to bite them. But of course, there's another side to the whole tale about snakes, isn't there? Look at the last chapter of the Acts of the Apostles, and let's read some verses from the beginning of Acts chapter 28. Ashore on Malta, the Apostle Paul. Once safely on shore, he says, Luke, we found out that the island was called Malta, Melita. The islanders showed us unusual kindness. They built a fire and welcomed us all because it was raining and cold, like here. Paul gathered a pile of brushwood, and as he put it on the fire, a viper, driven out by the heat, fastened itself on his hand. When the islanders saw the snake hanging from his hand, they said to each other, this man must be a murderer, for though he escaped from the sea, justice has not allowed him to live. But Paul shook the snake off into the fire and suffered no ill effects. The people expected him to swell up or suddenly fall over dead. But after waiting a long time and seeing nothing unusual happen to him, they changed their minds and said he must be a god. Then, back to our passage, what about the woodman? The quarrier, first of all, quarrying stone, and the woodman splitting logs. What's all this about? Well, it's really saying, remember realism, it's saying that all sorts of things can go wrong and do go wrong in life. But do they do so necessarily? So that we should always be afraid of the next moment, the next step, the next breath, turning the next corner? There is the inadvertent and the uncalled for, of course. But against that, a world of appalling chance. Against that, there are two things to be said. There is prudence and a reasonable degree of forethought and sensible precautions may be taken in life. The unsharpened axe head can be sharpened and not remain blunt, so that greater skill and strength is not required to do a normally simple and effective task. There's no specific suggestion here of the blunt axe head being dangerous, but you remember what we read in Deuteronomy 19:5. This is a rule about killing men and the cities of refuge. Deuteronomy 19:5. For instance, says the writer, a man may go into the forest with a neighbor to cut wood, and as he swings his axe to fell a tree, the head of the axe may fly off and hit his neighbor and kill him. That man may flee to one of these cities and save his life. The supposed manslaughter was innocently done because the woodman did not know the axe head would fly off. Ought he to have known? That's the question. Ordinary prudence needs to be applied to all tools and mechanical things and many other things as well. We are surely responsible, seat belts and all that, for making ourselves and our lives as safe as possible. But now to the case of the snake charmer. That's quite different. Back to the serpent again, though. I was going to say he's playing with fire, but really with poison, isn't it? He who charms snakes better hurry, lest the snake bites before it is charmed. And surely there's a profound lesson there to those who believe in the serpent and his poisonous work in this present evil world. The world is full of danger. Because there is a real live devil. The world is full of dangers, and he who would avoid them all would have to opt out of life and seek the quietness of the grave to live and to survive and make one's way successfully in life, whatever that may mean to different people, is to learn a whole philosophy of life. And this is necessary for the most unlettered people in the world. We've all to take precautions. Ordinary working folk with very little pretensions, but with a great fondness for living, may, without knowing it, acquire a great many skills. Think of all that even a laboring man has to know about money and wages and insurance and pensions and possibly even taxes. Or others who need to know about supplementary benefits. And some need to know about the provisions for the handicapped today. Think of what one needs to know before going out into the modern streets about crossings and observing signs and lights and how to behave in shops and offices. And when you go to the doctor or deal with your employer, we've been looking at that, or your ruler. The policeman, the registrar, the undertaker, the lawyer. We need to know a lot. One needs a great deal of know-how of one kind or another to get by in the most normal and ordinary prosaic life. So much can go wrong. Look at the newspapers and see of a Monday morning how many set out on journeys over the weekend and never reach their destination. I tremble as I say that. Because we'll be looking at our papers tomorrow. Dare we say that Christian people are less accident-prone than other people? I must be careful. Satan is listening. And he would love to make me eat my words involving distress to some of us, or those we love, and that would be terrible. But we don't know what the news will be tomorrow. Even tonight. The last thing I heard before I came out tonight was that Eric Wright is in hospital in Glasgow, quite ill. We don't know what a moment, let alone a day, may bring forth. But on, take verses 12 to 15. Let's look at those. Words from a wise man's mouth are gracious, but a fool is consumed by his own lips. Interesting word that. At the beginning, his words are folly. At the end, they are wicked madness, and the fool multiplies words. No one knows what is coming. Who can tell him what will happen after him? A fool's work wearies him. He does not know the way to town.
in 12 there, we have the contrast between the wise man and the fool, and as far as the latter is concerned, we are reminded of our first three verses. You know, about the bad smell and the heart on the left and the fool who walks in the road and lets the whole world know what a fool he is. But here, over against the wise man whose mouth utters gracious words, there is the foolish person. The wise man utters gracious words, which means that there is always present with him a restraint, a consideration for the truth and for others, as well as a desire to advance his own case. See how few of the politicians observe this. They're all too anxious, their words falling over one another in their desire to prove their case and make their point and win favor. But some of them, as mentioned, some of them, I think, do their case, which may be a perfectly good case or a decent enough case. They do it no good at all by their behavior. They certainly do not, in scriptural terms, adorn their doctrine, and are poor advocates of their doctrine, whatever it is. That's a good phrase or statement. The fool is consumed by his own lips. Verses 13 and the beginning of 14 show how the fool begins and how he ends. At first, he wallops his words about as if they were playthings, but they soon become charged with lethal effects. And as he continues, his demon becomes wilder and wilder until both madness and wickedness appear, and he does himself increasing disservice with every frantic phrase. People really think sometimes he's mad. You feel like saying to him, "Stop and take a breath, man, and give a thought to what you are saying and to the consequences of your vastly intemperate words." For he vows and predicts and threatens and prognosticates as if he were an oracle, when he knows no more about the future and what will transpire and what he will be able to do and not do than any other man. Who has the folly to listen to him? If he confined himself to stating a moderate case with expressions of hope and possible intention, and wait and see, and perhaps then, he might be listened to. But the arrogant cocksureness of the fellow destroys all credence, and one longs to get rid of such a creature. And in the end, he even tires himself out and has to stop for breath, when even a temporary pause might remind him that he is haywire and lost and has run ahead of himself to the extent that he doesn't know his way back to sanity or to his rightful home town. I cannot forbear to say that a certain former moderator of our church, who used to minister not a million miles from here, sometimes gets so excited in television that you feel he would swallow himself up, and spoils his case absolutely. The remaining verses have to do with our attitude to those who govern our country. And the word child in some versions is perhaps better servant in 16. But even if you use the word child, it is not referring to natural age. For
13 has already said that wisdom is not necessarily the prerogative of age. You see that verse? Better a poor but wise youth than an old but foolish king who no longer knows how to take warning. But it could be that the veteran is one who has never grown up, a rather odious Peter Pan. Isaiah 3:12 says something about that. Youths oppress my people, women rule over them. O my people, your guides lead you astray, they turn you from the path. Now, I don't think that the prophet is meaning necessarily young men, and he's certainly not meaning in Israel women ruling over them, but men who are but boys, or even women in the worst sense. Whereas in the case of both Jeremiah and King Josiah, you remember, who were contemporaries of each other, we have examples of youngsters who were filled with wisdom. Indeed, when you come to think of it, practically all the good kings of Israel and Judah, including David and Solomon too, were at their spiritual and moral best in their youth. Asa and Jehoshaphat and Isaiah, too. The only older man I can think of who turned and repented in old age was the worst king of all, Manasseh. Now, that fact, that most of these men were at their best in their youth, a remarkable thing. That never occurred to me until the time of writing this down. And I must think more about it. But surely it's a fact, a historical fact. And what a recommendation! What a recommendation for young rulers and leaders of national life and of the church. What do you think? Another category which is useless as rulers is that of those who feast in the morning. In Israel, the first responsibility of the king was to be up in the morning early and to be at his post at the gate of the city to hear the causes of his people, for he was judge as well as monarch. That was why wicked young Absalom stole the heart of Israel and stole a march on his aging parent David, you remember. Second Samuel 15:1. 2 Samuel 15:1. In the course of time, Absalom provided himself with a chariot and horses and with 50 men to run ahead of him. He would get up early and stand by the side of the road leading to the city gate. Whenever anyone came with a complaint to be placed before the king for a decision, Absalom would call out to him, "What town are you from?" And he would answer, "Your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel." Then Absalom would say, the plausible rascal, to him, "Look, your claims are valid and proper, but there is no representative of the king to hear you." And Absalom would add, "If only I were appointed judge in the land, then everyone who has a complaint or case could come to me, and I would see that he receives justice." Look also at Isaiah 5:11. With regard to this matter of feasting in the morning or indulging oneself or lying abed in the morning, as apparently David did when he got a little older and failed to go to war and
led to his deepest sin, that of Bathsheba. Woe to those who rise early in the morning to run after their drinks, who stay up late at night till they are inflamed with wine. They have harps and lyres at their banquets, tambourines and flutes and wine, but they have no regard for the deeds of the Lord. But of course, that happened earlier than that, in Amos's day, in luxurious Samaria. Amos 6 and 4, you lie on beds inlaid with ivory and lounge on your couches. You dine on choice lambs and fattened calves. You strum away on your harps like David and improvise on musical instruments. You drink wine by the bowlful and use the finest lotions, but you do not grieve over the ruin of Jacob, the northern tribes, Ephraim. Therefore you will be among the first to go into exile. And how true that came to be, your feasting and your lounging will end. But 17, verse 17, blessed are you, O land, whose king is of noble birth and whose princes eat at a proper time for strength and not for drunkenness. In that verse, the noble of birth and the princes referred to have not so much to do with lineage and traditional families as of those who are morally noble and who are princes in the way they live. Their lifestyle is princely in the best sense, who lead an ordered as well as a principled life and commend themselves to the people by the worthy way they go about things. Verse 8. Still thinking of rulers. Who wants a lazy ruler and an idle leader? And the astonishing thing is that decadent folk never seem to notice how decadent they are, even when others look on and see it. Even when they are set over against decent folk of orderly appearance and regular ways, they seem totally unaware of how sorted they are. They must notice the difference. But apparently, one sees this more and more today. They regard their slipshod, sordid, squalid ways with a kind of perverse superiority. There is, of course, the magnificent tramp. But these spoken of here are not like him. They reek and they smell with the sheer filth of their ways. And there have been those in history that have been monarchs in our own country like that. Indeed, often the filth of some of the so-called nobility and the gentry has been proverbial. At the same time, as the first two lines of verse 19 say, there is a place for rejoicing and festival at the right time. But what's that the preacher says about money? Now, in this context, it could refer to what it costs the king to carouse and indulge his excesses of extravagant living. And, of course, the people of this land at different times have been cursed with kings who fleeced the people of every vestige of legitimate sustenance to feed their own carnal desires, either for war to make war. How many generations in our nation have been impoverished by that? And even today, the cost of weapons, either for war or for their lives of luxury and license. But at the same time, at verse 20, we see that the king is the king. The ruler. The God-appointed authority, imperfect though he is, Romans 13, is the king. And it is wiser not to voice our thoughts, and perhaps even better, not to think them. For the thoughts we dwell on and ponder, you know, too deeply, have a way of communicating themselves in our demeanor. People know much more about what we are thinking and feeling and our attitudes than we think. So that people may know much more about what we are thinking than may be good for us in certain circumstances. Some people are adept at hiding what they feel under a carefully calculated camouflage of charm and bonhomie. And yet, many people, we do our brothers, our fellows a disservice when we deny them their discernment of us. They know us better than we think. In any case, we are sometimes told something in the strictest secrecy, and within a few days we find that it's all over the place. There are some things so inflammable that it is hardly possible to think them without something of their colour getting out. The world is full of tale-bearers, and not all of them wicked. But we all like a toothsome morsel and a diverting tale, even if, alas, it involves the plight or downfall of someone. Tell us about it, we say. It makes it all more like what we would call a good play, with some stomach and substance to it, someone's downfall. Would there be any plays at all if life went on as smoothly and normally as we would desire it to go on, and there was no seamy side to life? What would television do if life were all decent? They'd have to give up and become religious, and that would be the last straw. Dear me, they would say, what then is going to maintain our interest, let alone our happiness, not only on earth but in heaven, when there is no sin to plaster over the papers? What will we do in heaven? There'll be nothing for the heavenly TV sets to show. Aye, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit must have had a thin time in heaven from all eternity, with no sin at all to contemplate, except, alas, in prospect, if they were to dare to create on their worthy but costly terms. Would they permit free will, and the sin that would follow, and all the horrid excitement following that, and the drama of redemption? You see what I'm saying? But you see, the interesting thing is this. I don't know if it's strictly germane to these last verses, although it is certainly not a million miles from their drift, that to those who live an ordered life and who do not run to excesses of any kind, life is far more interesting than otherwise. For the truth is that righteousness is far more interesting than wickedness. If we could convince ourselves fully of that. I know that the devil would poo-poo the very idea that I've suggested. But the world of righteousness, think of it, has been so little explored. And so much contempt has been showered on rectitude. Especially today. I recall, as a piano accompanist in my teens, playing at a concert at Nigg Church Hall, and at the interval, one of the singers offered me a cigarette, and I said politely to him, "No thanks, I don't smoke." And the look of contempt on his face as he swept out of the room, muttering, "You must be a paragon of all virtues." I think that was the first time in my comparatively sheltered youth that I realized how hateful certain standards of good behavior were amongst the worldly. I felt positively unclean because I didn't smoke. Is it that wickedness is more interesting than righteousness? Let me pursue the subject. We cannot leave it unexplored now. No, it cannot be. It cannot be that for which God stands is less interesting than what the devil stands for. If that is so, then the whole world has turned uncorrectably upside down and is heading for disaster. What really happens is that the very restlessness of evil gives a false glamour to sin. You only need to read Genesis chapters 4 and 5 to see that. A false glamour to sin, as the serpent did to Adam and Eve. And in the process, it destroys or puts out of mind the whole concept of order and decency and the purposive and creative nature of a righteous way of life. It destroys the whole inner life of a good conscience with its peace before God and its poise and its power, which tends to turn life, you see, the other, tends to turn life into an unholy scramble, sets the cat among the pigeons and breeds on confusion and strife and dissension. Thinking about the difference between the two worlds, it occurs to me that Satan, having abandoned the true sanity of his creaturely existence, and being therefore inwardly impoverished, he had to substantiate some kind of life for himself by resorting to outward activity and getting all hot and bothered in the process about his way of running God's universe. And he had to work, and has to work very, very hard, poor creature, very hard. When you think of it, it's a wonder he didn't have all the planets colliding with each other. But fortunately, he was and is under the Almighty's control. Wouldn't he love to do it? The blighter. Yes, I mean it. The blighter. His very nature is to disrupt in order to justify his existence as an independent creature. So he thinks. But he simply succeeds in making a mess, not only of himself, the angel turned serpent, but in ruining everything he touches, everything he touches. Whereas the inner life of peace and poise is so creative, fascinatingly interesting. It creates worlds and worlds of new thought and explorations of mind and heart, so that heaven, you see, is likely to be, and perhaps we can understand this, heaven is likely to be a traveling further and further into the heart and mind of the Almighty God, and into interior and ventures of our own souls, knowing God more and more, and therefore knowing ourselves more and more. And it just occurs to me that that way we may learn much more about our God and about the mysteries of his being and his strange designs that we were singing about. We may learn much more in heaven than we could ever have dared to hope. Not that we can ever invade the sanctum of the Godhead, but we would not want to do that. Surely we wouldn't. There is something in the godly-minded heart of believing man that knows, as the hymn says, that his highest place is lying low at his Redeemer's feet. But yet, sharing some of the secrets of the Almighty. You know, Jesus said, I have no longer called you servants, because the servant doesn't know what his master is doing. That's the complaint of the angels, you see. The servant is simply to do what he's told without question. But he says, I have called you friends. And he goes on to say that he has told them, his disciples, everything his Father had made known to him. Well, there's an example of that in the Psalter. As we draw to a close, there's an example of that in Psalm 103:7. Famous verse. Very simple, but very profound, very telling. Now look at this. Psalm 103:7. The Lord works righteousness and justice for all the oppressed. He made known his way to Moses, but only his deeds to the people of Israel. You see that vast distinction of privilege? That simply gives a clue as to what increasing privileges the Father and the Son may have in store for us in heaven if we're down here, we'll walk in his way. And living under the Son, live by faith in him who is above the Son. We are to reign with him forever and ever. There will be plenty to do, and everything to interest us wisely and satisfyingly and creatively. In a world where all exciting evil has been done away, and all excitement, if such a word really applies at all excitement will be healthy and measured and balanced and beautiful and health-giving. in the right proportions. This will be life above the sun and by the other sun and by his blessed interior spirit. And that life, friend, begins down here and now. I'm not done yet. Sit back. Ho, everyone that thirsts, come to the waters, and he who has no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without price. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Hearken diligently to me, and eat what is good, and delight yourselves in fatness. Incline your ear and come to me. Hear that your soul may live, and I will make with you an everlasting covenant, even my steadfast, sure love.